There was a request to circulate Mara Makomo, so I prepared some Mara Makomo, which consist of various sources which I may or may not cite, and also a copy of a tshuva relating to an actual Beis Din case that I was involved in over 10 years ago.
Why long?
Where I took out the name of the party involved.
Great. But thank you. Talk once in a while.
Otherwise, it is germane to the subject. Okay, so this is the beginning of a series. So, Shiram, do you have Mara Makomos? I have extra ones up here if anybody needs. And the plan is to give this periodically to deal with various issues that have some relevance to what we deal with here at the CRC. And this is a subject where there's an overlap, I guess, between cases that come before the Beis Din, as well as some of the issues that regularly come up in terms of kashrus. So Sagas Gavul is something which, even at a recent kashrus commission meeting, we were discussing what the rights are of various establishments to register a protest if they think that there is a new establishment that will be encroaching upon its livelihood. We have certain built-in conflicts over here because there is a question as to whether the CFC will issue a hashkafa and it becomes a Beis Din issue that has to be adjudicated by our Beis Din. There is a financial and organizational relationship between our Beis Din and the kashrus department. I actually spoke with Rabbi Union, who is the menahel of the Beis Din at the RCC, at the Rabbinical Council of California. We have a relationship with him too. And I asked him what happens there when there is a hashkacha issue of whether to issue a hashkacha to a restaurant or in a supermarket that might be in competition with another restaurant or supermarket. Is that something that would be in any way dealt with by the organization itself or its Beis Din apparatus? And he said that we just tell them that the hashkacha, our organization, will go forward in terms of giving a hashkacha to anybody who's eligible to hashkacha. But if there is a hasagas gavul claim, they should bring it to a Beis Din, but not us. That seems to be a very sensible technique and approach towards these types of issues. Yes. But let me just give a little bit of... you missed the most important part. So let me just give a little bit of background to the whole hasagas gavul sugya altogether. Hasagas gavul technically doesn't even mean what it says. The pasuk in the Torah that deals with the issue of hasagas gavul is talking about something else entirely. That's a pasuk in Devarim and Perek Yutes, Los Hasig Gavul Reachasher Gavul Rishonim, which is a reference to Oker Tzuchum Chavero, that you have one property and you put the boundary lines a couple of inches further so that you make it seem like it's still your property, but you've encroached upon your chavis property. That's a violation of Los Tigzol, and if you do that in Eretz Yisrael, then it's a violation of real hasagas gavul. Los hasig gavul reyacha. That's applicable, as the pasuk says, to benachlas chashiyat timcha ba'aretz asher Hashem elokecha nosein lecha l'rishtah. That's a very specific violation for somebody who does that in Eretz Yisrael. Nonetheless, this term of hasagas gavul is used very broadly to cover the sugya in Baba Basra, and primarily in Daf Chaf Aleph from the base of Baba Basra. It deals with encroachment upon a person's livelihood, what might be called the halachic tort of tortious interference with another person's livelihood. And this is recorded as almost a fundamental principle of the Torah in a couple of places. There's a Gemara at the end of Makos on Daf Chaf Dalet Amud Aleph that says that David HaMelech in the Mizmor Tesvav in Tehillim took all of the Taryag Mitzvos and It's in Rashi's interpretation, you know, Taryag is too hard, so he whittled it down to 15. But obviously, we still have to keep all 613. But in terms of just codifying principles of the Taryag mitzvos, so one of the 11 that he was codified is lo asadur yehu ra'ah, not doing bad to your fellow man, shlo yavad umnus chavero, that it means not encroaching upon somebody else's livelihood. And there's even a more dramatic exposition in the Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Pei Aleph from an Aleph. Dorash Rabbi Yachav, Rabbi Chanina, Ves Eishes Reyehu Lotime. What is the meaning of not defiling the wife of your fellow? Sounds like Lo Sinaf. So the Gemara there says, no, it means Shloyeh Le'umeshesh Alumnus Chavero. That you should not descend upon your fellow's livelihood, and you should not jeopardize their livelihood. It seems that in actual application, what we call hasagas gvul, the encroachment of another person's livelihood, is not even so much in the domain as lo sigzol as it is in the domain of lo sinaf. It's considered as if you're actually violating a person's very essence when you encroach upon the person's livelihood. Now, in this sense, it's interesting that I suppose that there is nonetheless a connection to the idea that is expressed through the pasuk in Devarim that's talking about the case of pushing a person's boundary into somebody else's property, that's benachalas cha shir tinchal, that it happens to be that this particular claim of hasagas gavul that arises from the sources that talk about not to be yored l'umnus l'chavero have also traditionally in the world of Bezdin been very much confined and consigned to benachalascha asher tinchal. Even in the we've enjoyed Baruch Hashem in recent decades a resurgence in the popularity and the utilization of rabbinical courts. It's in part because people are frumer. It's in part because there's been a general rise in the usage of alternative dispute resolution forums where people are sick and tired of the court system and they look for arbitration tribunals that are more economic and that are more efficient, and if they're Jewish and particularly if they're from, they'll be more likely to go to Beis Din. But even before Beis Din became in vogue, even before it became more popular, when there were very few cases being brought to Beis Din, when many Batei Din were only really dealing with Gittin or dealing with cases where there was money under the table and they couldn't go to court because everybody would just be thrown into jail. Part of what was the bread and butter of cases that in those days, even in the olden days, were brought to Beis Din were hasagas gvul cases. The classical case of the fellow who has the pizza store and somebody wants to open up a pizza store across the street. Why is it that those cases were always coming to Beis Din, even when nobody was bringing any of their other kosher mishpah cases to Beis Din? It's because they would have had no cause of action whatsoever in civil court. So since the plaintiff knew that they would have no recourse except in Beis Din, so they would bring the case in Beis Din because they'd be laughed at of a courtroom. A capitalist society is premised upon principles of free enterprise and unbridled competition, and therefore it would be almost unheard of for a court to say, you can't open up your pizza store, you're going to drive the other poor guy out of business. That's simply not going to happen in a court of law. So this raises the question to what degree one has to take it into the cheshbon, the calculation of these cases, the dina de machus dina, the fact that in the civil society around us there are these notions of free enterprise. There's the, just to give you a little bit of the background of some of the laws that are on the books, there's the famous Sherman antitrust law that was promulgated in 1890, which states explicitly that you can't have tradespeople who will conspire in restraint of trade. That if there are regulations that people of a particular trade enact that would not enable every single person and every single store to be able to open and to be able to function, it was felt this is to the detriment of the consumer, and therefore this cannot be allowed. So that is one law to be taken into consideration if a particular enterprise is going to be restricted. There's an agreement among a community to restrict a particular enterprise. Does that run afoul of Sherman antitrust law? There's the Clayton Act from 1914, which outlawed predatory price cutting, that if there's the one big conglomerate store that sees that there's a small store that wants to open on the market, and they cut their prices because they can afford to suffer a loss for a couple of months and make absolutely no profit in order to drive the other small guy out of business, so that also runs afoul of legislation. This is a convenient law because it happens to be very consistent with what many understand the halacha to be as well. Then there's the Seller Kefauver Act of 1950, which prohibits the acquisition of by one firm of another firm's assets in a way that would create a monopoly so that you wouldn't allow for a competitive environment. So this raises the question that you have all of these antitrust laws on the books. Does that affect how the halacha would approach these types of situations? I saw that my chaver, Rabbi Jachta, quoted in one of his articles that the Rav Soloveitchik, apparently, this is Apishmua, I haven't seen this in writing, but in terms of the Rav's writings, but he quotes Apishmua that the Rav Soloveitchik held that there was never such a thing as a Hasagas Kabul case today in America. That when he was confronted with a case of one pizza store that wanted to open up next to another pizza store, the Rav apparently said that it doesn't matter what the considerations are of driving somebody out of business once you're living in a capitalist economy where anybody can open up al pi dina de machusadina, then you have no right to prevent anybody's entry into the marketplace. Now, this argument would be more understandable in a case where the store that's opening up is selling the types of goods and services where you, a Besdin, wouldn't be able to prevent, for example, a third party from opening up a similar store. If it's like a hardware store and you have two firm parties who come in front of the Besdin, and one says, I already have a hardware store, I don't want this other fellow to open up a hardware store. So then it's much more understandable to say that even if the Besdin would restrict the second person who's in the Besdin case from opening up his hardware store, they're not going to be able to stop the thousands of non-Jewish parties who live in the community from similarly opening up a hardware store. So you can understand that the Dina de Malchus de Dina might effectively preclude a valid Hasagas Gavul case under those circumstances, even if it otherwise would have been actionable according to halacha. However, I think that many assume that this type of an argument is much more dubious if you're dealing with people who are involved in an enterprise that can really only be entered into by people in the firm community, like you're opening up, you know, kosher pizza places or supply stores for kosher or Judaica type of products, where realistically you're not going to have people from outside the community open it up, and particularly if the kashrus type of enterprise that requires a hashgacha, and the hashgacha agency will say, we're not going to give you a hashgacha unless the Besdin rules in favor of allowing the second establishment to open up. So here there really are market controls that the firm community would be able to exercise that would mitigate the argument that since we live in a free enterprise system, therefore anybody else would be able to similarly open up a this type of establishment, and that therefore the Besdin can't interfere. So it's generally assumed that one can bring Hasagas Gavul cases. I'll tell you that most Hasagas Gavul cases get lost, meaning it's an uphill battle because, as we'll see, there's a tremendous threshold that needs to be met in order for somebody to successfully assert a Hasagas Gavul claim. But it's generally assumed that at least when there's a hashgacha involved and there's some sort of a control, and it's not likely that there are third parties who could easily enter into the market that's being adjudicated by the Besdin, that we do allow, at the very least, for the Hasagas Gavul cases to be brought. And while they might be laughed out of the courtroom, we don't laugh them out of the Besdin.
Can you explain why happens when I see them?
So, as a general principle, as the Shach says in Siman Ayin Gimel Chol Shemishpa, whenever you have two Jewish parties who are involved in a dispute, Dina de Malchus de Dina, even though it might be a monetary regulation, it's generally not binding upon Jewish parties in terms of their interactions and regulations with each other. If their interactions would implicate the larger society, so then we probably would apply principles of Dina de Malchusa. Rav Henkin has a letter like this, that whenever there are general enactments like rent control laws or bankruptcy laws, you can't carve out two people from a larger group and a larger society in terms of the reach of the laws, even in a particular transaction is intended for the economic welfare of the larger society, so then we would apply Dina de Malchusa Dina, even if the two parties who are in this individual dispute or this individual interaction or transaction are standing in front of the Beis Din. But let's say I have a dispute just between two Jewish parties over an inheritance matter, over a partnership matter, or over a neighborly dispute regarding what you're allowed to do in your property, where the only affected parties would be the Jewish parties who are appearing before the Beis Din. So then, according to the principle of the Shach, we would not apply the notion of Dina de Malchusa Dina. Rav Moshe Feinstein, Choshen Mishpach, Chelek Beis Din, and Tzamach Beis, also articulates a similar principle. If you look in the Beis Yosef in Siman Chavav of Shulchan Aruch, so the Beis Yosef has, I think, actually Siman Shin Samach Tes towards the end of Choshen Mishpach, he quotes from Rabbi Yaakov Yisrael, who seems to favorably accept the following principle, which is that if you have an economic regulation of the sort where two private parties can decide on their own that they're not going to follow the default rules of the government, at least between themselves, so then Dina de Malchusa Dina would not be applicable. But if the government would care, if they would be makbid, if they would say, we're not going to let you privately contract out of the law, we're going to penalize you for it, or we're not going to allow for your private determination or your private contract to stand, like, one creditor who makes a private deal with a bankruptcy debtor, for example, where the government's not going to allow that to stand. So then, in such a case, we would apply the principle of Dina de Malchusa Dina. So we do.
So we pay the trade piece on the government.
So in that sense, you have to delineate what you're talking about. The government might care about that you don't violate any of the restrictive rule, like, for example, collusion. If you have an actual case of collusion, so then the government would probably care. If you have predatory price cutting, so then the government would probably care. But would the government care, you have broader principles. There are principles of free enterprise and like. So sometimes, the government might say, from our perspective, something is mutter, but if you don't do it, we're not going to consider it to be usser either. There's free enterprise. The Sherman Act doesn't say that no matter what, there must be unbridled free enterprise, and otherwise it's a violation of Dina de Malchusa Dina. It says that there can't be conspiracies in restriction of trade. So while it may be true that according to the Dina de Malchusa you have the right to free enterprise, if a Bezdin would say that in our own community we're not going to give a hashgacha to a restaurant that's going to undercut the business of another restaurant, that might not actually be a violation of a Dina de Malchusa. In other words, there might be a range where it might not be fully free enterprise, but it might not be a violation of any of the antitrust rules either. And because this is a very delicate area, a Beis Din has to be careful about that. Even in terms of submitting these disputes for arbitration, there is actually Supreme Court cases that have recently been passed about the question whether if there's an antitrust case where somebody is asserting that one company is taking over more than its share of the market or is engaged in collusion and so forth.
What is collusion?
collusion means, let's say I have two different companies in a particular industry that are the major companies in the industry, and they say we're going to collude with each other, then neither of us are going to sell beneath below a certain price to the customer. So the customers end up getting hurt because the market might be able to bear lower prices, but they collude with each other that they're going to charge this particular price. So I would sometimes I remember being sensitive to these laws. I remember being called by one of my colleagues when I was at the Bezdin in New York. Every so often we would raise get prices in terms of how much we would charge for a get, you know, just based on the cost of how much, you know, how much money was necessary in order to pay the sofer and the adim and the overhead of the office, just how much everything cost as inflation, you know, went up. So we had to raise the prices from time to time. So I would have sometimes a colleague of mine from a different business would call up and say, you know, I'm thinking of raising prices. You know, are you going to raise prices to the following amount? Because if you raise the following amount, then I'll be able to raise the following amount as well. Because, you know, we should be united in terms of price that charge. And I would always be very cautious and circumspect about having that conversation with him and say, I don't know, of course, we look into it and we'll see what happens. But I would never continue that conversation. I figured, obviously, people can find out through the grapevine whether another Bezdin raised its price or whether it didn't raise its price, but I felt that it was dangerous to have that conversation.
What about the other side? If someone comes to you and they say, I will open the pizza shop and he has one there ready, are you not restraining trade by deciding that I can't have that
sort? So that might not necessarily be as much. If you're not price fixing is very specifically stipulated. If you're talking about whether to allow somebody to come into the market, whether not to allow somebody to come into the market, that is not necessarily as clear cut. Which is why it's very important just to be cognizant of the fact that there are limits, there are certain broad public policy rules when it comes to antitrust that a Bezdin does not want to violate when it hears these cases. Now, there are a couple of cases from the Supreme Court over the last 25 years or so that indicate that these types of cases can be submitted to arbitration. So the mere fact that you're dealing with collusion claims or price-fixing claims or predatory pricing claims or free enterprise claims by itself would not be a violation of any type of law for Bezdin to hear the case. One case was called Mitsubishi Motors from 1986, which said antitrust matters can be submitted to arbitration. That was talking about with respect to the international market, but it's understood as applying to the local market as well. And one case is the AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion, which is the 2001 case that says that even if parties say that they're forfeiting their rights to a class action suit with respect to antitrust claims by saying that they'll submit it to arbitration, and they might do better if it had been a class action, the fact that they gave up their right to a class action is something which is enforceable and it could still go to arbitration. So we know that the matters can be submitted to arbitration, but what the Supreme Court said is that when you have an arbitration tribunal, it didn't specifically mention Bezdin, but when you have any type of arbitration tribunal that would hear this case, they have to comply with the various federal statutes. And obviously, Bezdin has to be careful not to get into trouble by violating even inadvertently the Sherman Antitrust Act or the Clayton Act or any of these other statutes. What we used to do at the Bezdin of America, which I thought was very clever and very cute, when we had these types of cases, you got to wonder how much the federal government cares about the pizza parlor cases, you know. But you know, when somebody's, I've never heard of a case where anybody challenged the decision of a Bezdin regarding Hasadis Gvul on antitrust grounds. Even though there are probably dozens and dozens of such cases, I'm just not aware of any such case. But what we would do, just liesis to ace, and for extra protection, was that whenever we would hear such a case, we would put on the panel. We would have two regular dayanim on the panel, and then we would round out the panel. The third dayan was not a musmach, but a firm fellow who was an antitrust partner at the law firm of Wachtel, Lipton, Rosen and Katz, which is one of the most prestigious law firms in the entire country, and he was actually an antitrust partner in the law firm, and we would have him sit on the case so he could make sure that whatever decision was arrived at by the Bezdin, it was in compliance compliance with any dina de machus de dina concerns. So
not in accordance with dina de machus de dina put the best in at risk.
It could potentially. You have to be very careful. If it's felt that the Bezdin is involved in some way, as Rabbi Cohen pointed out, in facilitating a restraint of trade, so you could potentially put yourself at risk. You could always claim some type of religious exemption, but nonetheless, you just want to be on the... So it's interesting. I thought that was a good solution as well. To say that it's also pihalacha. I'm not sure exactly, I don't remember exactly the reasoning, but I think one of the attorneys told me afterwards that it's actually worse to phrase it that way than to say that we are, you know, ruling that you simply are not allowed to do this. I don't know exactly, I don't remember the reasoning for that, but even something like that where you would figure that you just issue a decision saying this is what I'm telling you what to do, but it's also pihalacha, if it's in the context of an arbitration agreement, and it's in the context where you know that as a result of your determination, Ashkafa is not going to be given, the person is not going to be able to enter the market, so then that might actually be more problematic.
But the point of two litigants coming to a Din Torah and agreeing to abide by it, aren't they, so to speak, moichel? They're using their Miranda rights, and they talk anyway.
So that's what I was saying before. It doesn't matter so much if they're moichel. If the government doesn't allow two people to be moichel, so then you still are subject to dina de machus, the dina concerns.
Is that a fact of law?
That's not only a fact of law, it's a fact of halacha as well. But of course it's a fact of law. If I have a creditor who colludes with a debtor in a bankruptcy proceeding, that they're between themselves, they're not going to respect the automatic stay. The fact that the two people on their own have decided to opt out of the rest of the class, and as a result, the other creditors are going to get paid any money, so that is something which would not be permissible as
you,
a general rule.
You took a very interesting example. Many years ago we had a company that was every year went into bankruptcy, but they would always pay us. So now that I think back, maybe we should debrief them, but they're out of business.
There are ways of making deals with creditors where it has to be done through the court. There are certain opt-out provisions that can be made, but all of these things have to be very formally registered.
In these matters, does it go by the letter of the law or the spirit of the law? What I mean is like this, in many areas when it comes to government and let's say in criminal or lots of times they say, listen, rabbis, you take care of your community and we have respect. You'll kind of take care of your problems and you know, we'll look the other way because we want you. We know you can do the best job of taking care of your issues.
It could be these conversations take place in Chicago. I don't know the lay of the land that well. As
far
as a general principle, it's not usually the way that that the law works, at least not officially anyway. Okay, now the truth of the matter is that the actual halacha is much more in conformity with free enterprise. So the tension between the dina de machus hadina and the halacha really at the end of the day is not that great, which is probably one of the reasons why that antitrust partner is always, continues to be comfortable sitting on these types of cases. The Gemara Rabba Basra on Daf Kabbalah of Amud Beis has the machlokis between Rafuna and Rafuna Breid Rabbi Yoshua as to whether one person who is a member of a mavoi who's engaged in a particular business, the business there is Uki Rechaya, that he has a grinding mill, whether that person can stop somebody else in the same neighborhood, in the same mavoi, from engaging in that business. According to Rafuna, the first person who had established a rechayim has the right to stop the second person from entering into the neighborhood with the same business, because he can say, because pasakta le v'chiyuste, that you are cutting off my livelihood. At the end of the sugya, the Gemara quotes Rav Huna Breid Rav Yoshua, and notes that this is consistent with the machlokes tanaim between the Chachamim Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, with Rav Huna Breid Rav Yoshua being in the camp of the Chachamim, and Rav Huna, the restrictive opinion being in the camp of Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. Rav Huna Breid Rav Yoshua says it's perfectly fine. We have a general principle that ani osev etoch shli v'ata osev etoch shelcha. that I have set up my Reichaim, whoever wants to come to me will come to me. You set up your Reichaim, whoever wants to come to you will come to you. The Gemara gives kind of the analogous example of the two storekeepers where we encourage competition, where we say it's perfectly permissible that even for one storekeeper to give out free walnuts to the children who come to shop in their store, even though that's going to make the children want to come back and to persuade their parents to shop in that store and not the other store, because the one storekeeper can say to the other, Anakim Efalgina Emguzi Ad Polk Shiuski, I am distributing walnuts, you can distribute almonds, that we both have equal ability to persuade people to come to our respective stores, and therefore it's considered to be perfectly permissible. The Gemara leaves it as a teku, whether, according to Rav Huna Brei de Rabbi Yehoshua, it's permissible for a person of one mavoi. It's generally assumed by the contemporary Batei Din that a mavoi for these purposes means a neighborhood. You know, what would be present-day neighborhood. We don't have so many halachic mavois, you know, per se anymore, leaving Parkside Estates aside. Most places aren't, you know, built that way bisman hazeh. So a mavoi really means a neighborhood. The question is, can a person from one neighborhood prevent another person from a different neighborhood but from the same city into entering into their neighborhood to engage in a similar business? That's left as a teku. In all teku cases that have to do with abominus, the person who we do not allow restraint for the person to do what they want to do, and therefore effectively that would result as well in a permissive ruling on the part of Rav Huna Brei de Rabbi Yehoshua. The one case where Rav Huna Brei de Rabbi Yehoshua is machmir is that if a person wants to come from completely outside of the city and the person doesn't share in sustaining the burden of the city by paying taxes and the like, so a person can't come from a different city to compete with a resident of that city in terms of their livelihood. But even there, there's an exception in the event that the person is prepared to pay taxes. A little bit of a machlokus about what if they're only beginning to pay taxes now, but a year ago they didn't pay taxes and they're only doing it in order to enter into the business. A little bit of machlokus we showed them. It's generally assumed that it doesn't really matter even if they start now. If they're willing to pay the taxes, then that would be good enough. Rav Tzvi Spitz, who's the Dayan in Eretz Yisrael, who wrote an entire volume about issues of business law, it's Chelek Beis of the Minchas Tzvi. So in his Siman Hey of Chelek Beis of the Minchas Tzvi, so he has a lengthy discussion of some of these issues, and his claim is that nowadays the tax consideration is not applicable at all, according to the opinion of Rav Huna Brei de Rabbi Yehoshua. That's only if, as a result of one more person operating within the city, everybody else's tax burden is going to increase, so therefore we need them to be able to share in the tax burden. He said that's not the way that cities nowadays operate, that the tax burden is not going, every single person has their own individual tax burden, but the city as a whole, it's not going to have a collective tax burden that's going to be increased and that has to now be shouldered in greater measure because somebody else is entering into the city. So therefore, even if somebody is entering from completely outside of the city and they refuse to pay taxes altogether, that's between them and Uncle Sam. That has nothing to do with their relationship with the other residents of the city, and therefore, according to the Shita, they would be allowed to open up. The halacha is like Rav Huna Brei de Rabbi Yehoshua. Rav Huna Brei de Rabbi Yehoshua was later in time than Rav Huna, and the halacha is Kibasrai. Tosos notes that on the daf that we follow Rav Huna Brei de Rabbi Yehoshua. So it would seem at the end of the day that the halacha really is very much in consonance with this notion of free enterprise, which is Anakma Pagina Amguzi Ad Paluga Shiyuski, every man to himself. We all have the equal opportunity to compete, and therefore there shouldn't be a problem whenever anybody wants to open up a competing store. However, there is the Shita of the Abiyasaf that kind of qualifies what appears to be this halacha. First of all, you have to kind of measure this halacha and the maskana of the Gemara here in relation to the Gemaras that we quoted at the beginning in Makos and in Sanhedrin and the like, which indicate that there's some horrid crime that's being committed when you're Yored Lubnus Chavero. There's a Rashi in Yevamos that talks about somebody who calls someone else in Russia, that it shouldn't justify being, you know, Yored Imo Lachayev, that you would have the ability at that point to hurt the person's livelihood. And Rashi says that this is not something that should be done, this is improper. So it appears like there is this still existing notion that at least in some set of circumstances you can't be Yored Lubnus Chavero. So the Chasam Sofer has a few tshuvas on this subject. Probably the most well known and lengthy tshuva that Chasam Sofer has on this subject is in Siman Ayin Tet in Choshen Mishpat. And the Chasam Sofer quotes from the Chavos Yair, who says, well, you know, all the other Gemaras are kind of like ethical propositions. They're things that you're allowed to do, but as a Midas Chasidus, you know, you're going to open up a store, you're going to hurt someone else's livelihood, so it's not a nice thing to do. And that's why you say, David HaMelech, Amidah Nalachatzitzrei, David HaMelech formulated 11 general principles of the Torah. So these are considered, they're supposed to be ethical principles. So it's an ethical principle. You're not supposed to be Yored Lumnus Chavero. So Chasam Sofer says, but David HaMelech was condensing or summarizing Tarjag Mitzvos. He wasn't summarizing Mesilos Yisharim. It was these are 613 binding mitzvahs, binding commandments, and therefore the 11 principles of David HaMelech are similarly binding. There must be certain cases where, in fact, you would not be allowed to be Yored Lubnus Chavero. So the Abi Yosef.
He was condensing the whole Torah, even though it sounds like an ethical principle, but it obviously was about the philosophy of the Lubnus Chavero.
Sure, but you know, the person wants to open up the business will say it's not Sunny LA. I don't know, he can keep his business open. I think that, you know, that would have been fine. If I would have had my business and he opens up his business, I'm fine with it.
Open up on him and
he would say that's fine. That's why I'm doing it too, because I think we could both coexist and I'll drive him out of business. I'm a better businessman than me. So that's than he is. That's fine. So the Abi Yosef says that let's say you have a Mavoi Sosum. You have an alleyway which is closed on three sides, and somebody had the rechayim that was set up all the way at the end point of the mavoi, and now somebody else comes along, and it could be from the same mavoi, from a different mavoi in the same city, or from a different, you know, where it would be permissible for them to set up a rechayim in the same mavoi, halacha lemaaseh, but the person sets it up at the very entrance way of the mavoi. So says the Abi Yosef here, everybody who wants to have their, you know, grain ground up in the mill is going to stop by the person who's at the entryway, and they have no incentive whatsoever to go to the person who's all the way at the end of the mavoi. Some say that it's not just that they have no incentive, they won't even know about it because of the deafening noise of the mill that's at the entrance of the mavoi, so they won't even hear the noise of the mill that's on the other side of the mavoi. They won't even know that it exists altogether, and therefore, effectively, the person who's now standing up the mavoi at the entranceway is complete, not only competing with the person on the other end, but they are completely extinguishing their livelihood. So says the Abi Yosef, it's going to be a complete eradication of the other person's livelihood. So then under those circumstances, it would be impermissible.
The people on the other end of the mavoi, most of them, they just don't go to that guy.
So this is assuming that, you know, in order for the business to succeed, they rely upon others from the outside moving into this mavoi, coming into this mavoi. That if it's a mavoi, maybe five residents or whatever in the entire mavoi, that if you would only rely upon the people who are in the mavoi, you're just not going to be able to sustain enough of a business. So the Chasam Sofer distinguishes between the notion of chulshus chiyusei, where you might be weakening the person's livelihood, which is okay, and pisuk chiyusei, where you're completely destroying the person's livelihood, which is not okay. The Ramah does not quote the Abi Yosef in the Shulchan Aruch. He does quote the Abi Yosef in the Darchei Moshe. But more significantly, the Ramah quotes the Abi Yosef in one of the Tshuvas of Ramah, in Siman Yud, of the Tshuvas of Ramah, he quotes the Abi Yosef as being authoritative halacha lemaaseh, in a case where there was somebody who had published the writings of the Rambam. Maram Padova had published the writings of the Rambam, and somebody else came along, a non-Jewish, merchant came along and decided, wow, the Rambam really sells, so I want to publish the Rambam as well. You know, I don't know if you have this so much nowadays. So this non-Jewish merchant published the Rambam, and he sold it at one dinar less. And the problem with this was that that was the dinar of profit for Maran Padova. He was only getting the profit from that dinar. Otherwise, it would have been completely cost, and he would make no profit whatsoever. And the Shiva Sarama says that as a result of what this other person is doing, it's completely undermining 100%. It's destroyed the livelihood and the parnasa of Maran Padova, and therefore it's prohibited from him to do so. Now, of course, Rama had no jurisdiction over this non-Jewish merchant. So the way in which the Rama enforced this psak was to say that all the Jewish consumers, all the Jewish customers, were prohibited from buying this other edition, so that they would not support the person who was improperly undercutting the Maran Padova in his edition of the Rama.
After the consumer. Was it really awesome for the guy to do what he was doing?
So he said it was awesome. Yes, he held it. He has a long discussion there about the goyim are also subject to dinim, and as a result of their being subject to dinim, they're subject to all of dinei chol shemishpat, and since this is included within chol shemishpat, there's a lot in that shuras of Ramah that one can, you know, pilpul about, but we're just focusing on this one aspect of the Ramah. So Ramah favorably quoted the Abiyasa. Now, the base Yosef.
What about restraint of trade? Well, how would that fit in with restraint of trade?
Well, he didn't have that particular consideration. In Krakow, I guess.
No, because we've had that. We were once threatened with a lawsuit, a similar type of a case.
Ah, so you were threatened with a potential
lawsuit. Absolutely,
right.
By a very substantial.
So that's why, as I said at the beginning, that when you're actually dealing with a case, you do have to make sure not to violate any of the Dina de Machusa rules that the government is makbid about. Because if they're makbid about it, so then it would fall within the framework of Dina de Machusa Dina. I don't know that this would constitute restraint of trade per se in this particular case. Usually that refers to cases of collusion and the like, but you know, that's why you need to have good attorneys, like, you know, an antitrust partner and a prestigious law firm to help to, you know, advise you about those particular issues. But it seems like Rav Soloveitchik felt that that was dispositive in any of these types of cases. So in that particular case, the Ramah, you know, held that clearly we should take the Abiyasa into consideration. The Beis Yosef in Simen Kuf Nun Vav in Choshe Mishpat quotes the Abiyasa and says the Abiyasa is going according to the opinion of Rafuna. Since we don't paskin like Rafuna, therefore we don't paskin like the Abiyasa. And Adayom Azeh, there is a dispute among different poskim as to whether we really paskin like the Abiyasa or whether we don't paskin like the Abiyasa. Now, Rav Moshe seems to accept the approach of the Abiyasa. Rav Moshe in the tshuva that I have in the materials here, which is Choshe Mishpat Chelek Aleph Simen Lamed Ches, dealing with a shul enterprise, where I guess that there was an expectation of profit, of maybe selling the shul and making money from the shul. Not exactly clear. It was clear that there was a financial consideration in terms of those who had a particular shul, that they would lose money if there was another shul that was created in the community. There was another shul that was created in the community, and even though that was a completely not-for-profit and nobody was looking to make money off of it, but Moshe said that makes it worse, because if I have two competing business people, you could say, well, each person is Aniyo Sevatok Shli, Vatar Sevatok Shalcha, and each person has the right to try to make a living. Here, the second shul was there only to destroy the first shul, and was not there to make a living, you know, as opposed to the first shul, which was, I guess, some sort of like a privately owned, you know, shtibo on some level, where the people would make some money off of it. So Moshe said this actually makes it worse. And Rav Moshe quotes the Rashi in the Baba Messiah, Zafa Ayin, from the case of, you know, somebody who calls somebody else a Rasha, Yoyim Olachayev, where Rashi says, some say that means that you could be Mimayik Mizonosov Shochavero, that you can be Yoyim Olachayev in terms of being Yoyim Lumnoso, in terms of decreasing his livelihood. And Rashi says, that can't be Pshat, because of course that's something which is forbidden. You're not allowed to reduce a person's livelihood. So Rav Moshe is Medayek from that Rashi, that it's not only destroying a person's livelihood that's impermissible, but if you would reduce the person's livelihood so that they would not be able to subsist according to their socioeconomic class, the way that Rav Moshe presents it, where he, you know, defines Yoyim Olachayev in accordance with Kedei Chayev in Hilchos Ribbitz, and he says, you know, that as a result of the definition of terms of Kedei Chayev, when we say that, when Rashi says that you can't be memayit mezenosav shel chavero, Rashi means that it's improper even to hurt somebody's livelihood to the degree where they would fall below their socioeconomic class in terms of being able to make ends meet properly, despite the fact that they might still retain a certain low-level profit margin. So Rav Moshe extended this principle of the Avi Yosef, this principle of the Chasam Sofer, even further, and most of the claims that are brought to Beis Din Bizman Hazeh rely upon these various shitos, because if you didn't have these various shitos, there wouldn't be too much to protest when you have, for example, one pizza place that's simply opening up across the street from another pizza place, and then there is an analysis about they didn't do if they're taking these shitos seriously, if they're, you know, assuming like Rav Moshe that they do a market analysis, would there in fact be a decrease in the person's livelihood? So the Beis Din of America had a case a number of years ago regarding two chocolate stores. So the first chocolate store was not just selling chocolate, it was selling all kinds of candies, but they also sold chocolates, and they were Parag chocolates. And then there was another store that opened up nearby in the neighborhood where they only sold chocolates, but they sold, like, you know, a gourmet line of chocolates, and at the beginning they weren't selling Parag chocolates, they were only selling dairy chocolates, so everybody was fine, and the first store decided it was not going to bring a Hasagas Gavul claim. But then after a while, the second store decided, you know what, people, you know, really like our chocolates, and there's really a big market for Parag chocolates. I mean, people have to have, you know, what to eat, you know, Shabbos, or, you know, it's a Pesach resort, and they need a tea room, and they're still pleasure, so they need to have, you know, a good line of Parag chocolates, so they started to prepare gourmet chocolates as well. The Beis Din noted in ruling favorably for the second store to be able to sell the chocolates that the first store wasn't really making ends meet to begin with. It's not as if they really had a viable business plan or business entity, number one. And number two, that once the second store started to make chocolates more attractive in terms of the chocolates that they were selling, then that actually increased kind of the business retail establishments where both stores operated. More people were coming into the area, and the first store actually was doing much better ever since the second store moved into the neighborhood and introduced its, you know, Parag chocolate line. So Beis Din said sometimes a proliferation of businesses is better for everybody. It's kind of like, you know, the shopping center or mall model, and therefore, you know, that was
mall.
Not. I'm sorry.
10 women's shoe stores in every mall.
Exactly.
All great because people go from store to store. That's the most common store, I believe, in the mall, is the women's shoe store.
So he said, if you have the business establishment, so that's good for everybody. It's kind of like, you know, the post can talk about, you have the Yom HaDeShuk, you have the day of the marketplace, where regardless of anyone shita, everybody agrees, you know, that the people from outside, from other cities, even if they don't join in the taxes, they can sell on that day, because the more merchants come together on the Yom HaDeShuk, so the better everybody does. So that's one of the heterim. So if you have like a business center where the more stores is going to be better for everybody, so that's also something to be taken into account. But there's another consideration, like in the chocolate store case, which really I think applies to many of the Hasagas Gvul disputes nowadays, which is the sheet of the Rimigash. So the Rimigash says that all of these different, you know, sheetos, Rapuna Breda of Yeshua, you know, even if you would have some sort of a restriction on trade, that's only if you're dealing with a non-differentiated homogeneous product where, you know, you have two mills and they're basically doing the same thing and the end product is going to be the same and they're charging the same price. But he says that if you have a one store that has a superior product or has a different product, so then the first store has no right to stop the second store from opening because there's such a thing as the rights of the consumer, the rights of the lochim. So you have to be vigilant on behalf of the lochim as of the lukuchos. They also have rights, and they have the right to a greater variety of products. So if it's a different product, so then the first store owner never has the right to stop the second store owner, the second business from opening up. So in this case as well, the second chocolate store was producing more gourmet-style chocolates with superior ingredients, superior processes. You can't say the two chocolates are necessarily the same. It's interesting, in most of the pizza disputes that I have been involved with, generally speaking, that argument is not considered to be a winning argument. For some reason, Dayanim seem to assume that all pizzas taste the same, that it's considered to be a relatively homogeneous product.
I make better pizza?
Right, but it seems to me, as a consumer, you know, I was once speaking to Rosh Schechter about this, you know, when we had a case of, you know, competing pizza stores. So Rosh Schechter said, well, you know, maybe I prefer the pizza in the second place. You know, that sometimes people actually have a preference. The pizza tastes better in the second place.
For those cases,
you
need the yeshiva.
So the Rimi Gash says, so the Rimi Gash says that if you have a superior product, so then you also have no right to make this assertion. So, and therefore, in many cases, right, that's a consideration as well. In many of these cases, that you could have a differentiated product, and it's only, you know, really a potential violation, even according to the Abiyah Sof and even according to Stam Sofer, if you have a product which is more or less the same. Now, the Ramban argues with the Rimi Gash about a lower price as simply being grounds for unbridled competition or for free enterprise, because he says otherwise, he says it doesn't make sense to say that, because then you should never disallow a person from another city who's not paying the taxes to come into your city to sell the product, because by definition, when you have more merchants, it's going to cause the price to go down. So therefore, the very fact that even Rav Huna Breis, Rav Yeshua says that's usher shows that the mere fact that prices that one price is going to be cheaper, is going to be a cheaper price, is not a justification in cases that would otherwise be hasad this kabul. So there are those who deal with this particular issue, and there's a tshuva galechem rav from the Mechaber galechem Mishnah Siman Reish Tes Zayin, where he actually goes through the sugya very, very nicely in a case as well, where you have one person who was a tailor, a lot of tailor cases, where there was one tailor who was charging one price, another tailor comes in and wants to charge a lower price, and he quotes the Machlokas, the Ramban, and the Rimi Gash, and he says everybody would agree, even the Ramban should agree with the Rimi Gash, when the second merchant is charging a significantly lower price, because when you have somebody who's coming in from another city, so that would just cause prices to go down a little bit, so that's not significant enough to justify it. But if it's really going to be a major benefit to consumers, that the price is going to go down significantly, the person's really going to be able to charge a much lower price, therefore then that should be okay. Now that's only okay to the point in which it's not predatory pricing. And the Aruch HaShulchan says this very pointedly as well, that if it's going to be predatory pricing, where you're mekalkalin da'alchei ha-mischor, is the way that the Aruch HaShulchan presents it, so that obviously is impermissible, because then you're really driving the lower merchant out of business, and you're doing it in a way in which you might be distributing the amguzi, but he doesn't have the ability to distribute the shiuski, because he just doesn't have the same ability to sustain losses for a long period of time. Now, if the second merchant is simply a more efficient operation, and if the first merchant would be more efficient, they would be able to charge a lower prices, that's perfectly permissible. That's the case that the Lechem Rav is talking about. Presumably that's what the Rimi Gash is talking about. But if the first merchant is deliberately sustaining a loss for the purpose of driving the second person out of business, because they know that they can sustain a loss for a long period of time because they have more reserves, for example, it's not that their business model is better per se, it's just that they have more resources, they have more money, so then that's something which would be impermissible. Similarly, if you have, you know, someone who, just because of their, you know, the nature of their establishment, they're able to charge, you know, much lower prices because of the fact that they have a much more, they have a greater wholesale business, or they have or they have greater reserves, that because they're such a conglomerate organization, then to me, that's an open-ended question that I don't have the answer to, but I think that, you know, that's something which we really do do need to consider in cases where you have like a large supermarket chain that comes into town and has the ability to charge much lower prices because they have the ability to have the business model where that's a possibility for them, but it's not a possibility for the smaller, long-standing establishments that are already in the community that are just on a local level that might be driven out of business because of this large conglomerate establishment that comes into town. I think that's a much more dubious question that obviously a Beis Din needs to reckon with. To what degree do we say the small mom-and-pop operation has the ability to become a conglomerate itself, or to what degree do we say that there's a place for mom-and-pop establishments as well, and the fact that this new place is going to engage in the type of pricing that will drive them out of business is something which can't be permitted under these circumstances. Let me just mention...
A company was considered our house, of course, it's a local little fund. What would be the air price for the first year? Because we're thinking long-term that, you know, over this many years we're going to make money, but they literally won't be able to pay much deal if they don't get the money coming in. So we can't charge them a lower price. We're basically taking the loss. We're going to pay much deal, and we're going to charge them almost nothing the first 2 years, because we have a long-term plan. So for us, it's sort of like a... We're willing to take a loss today, which the loon guy can't do. The bottom of no place.
If your taking of the loss is predatory in nature, meaning that if it's for the purpose of driving somebody out, so then that would be very problematic. If it's not for the purpose of driving somebody out, it's for good customer relations, so that might be better. The Minchas Tzvi suggests that intent is very important in these cases as well.
Translates in the words that we do it in other cases. Mm-hmm. But this is modus operandi that we do it from time to time anyway, which in his question we do, so then it's not intent to drive them out.
I don't intend to drive anybody out, I intend to get this particular customer. But we don't doing it again. Generally try to close that extra down. We don't do it, but get this. Nobody's there. This customer's out.
Yeah.
He has a local body who's said we'll charge this down. And we'll say, you know, we can do it. That's a fair price. For the first 2 years, we'll give him for half the price. Just because we know we'll get the business. And long term, we can do it, and he can't afford that. He can't see our brand name going as a superior product.
I think there's a big difference, you know, if it's, you know, somebody who has come to you anyway because of your reputation, then you're giving, you know, the person a deal. I think that's probably different from if you're aggressively competing because of the fact that you know that there is another, you know, VAD that the person might consider, and you're only giving the deal on that basis. If you normally do this because it's part of, you know, how you operate, so that might be better, but I'm not saying for sure one way or another. I really just want to raise what the different considerations are. Now, there are just two other brief points that I want to make before we wrap this up for today. One is that the Gemara, in the course of its discussion on Daf Chaf Aleph from Beis, talks about the case of Dogim Shiyavi Sira. It talks about the case of you have a fish that one fisherman has spread out his net and therefore is drawing the fish to come near him, that it's prohibited for another fisherman to come along and to take away those fish. And the Gemara indicates that this is something that potentially everybody agrees would be prohibited. And this is the question. The Rambam, Shulchan Aruch don't codify the case of Dagim Diavi Sayara in the Lahalacha.
It means that you're
going to cause the fish who otherwise had the first fisherman had the expectation that the fish was were going to go to him, okay, because he already spread his nets, he already put in the bait, the mizonos, the fish are already heading in that direction. As a result of somebody else intervening and putting in a net, you know, before the other net, as a result that fisherman is going to lose the fish. Okay, so many of the poskim assume that this really does stand the halacha. Tosfos in a number of places quotes this case and seems to indicate that this case is still true halacha. And Tosfos says, you know why this case stands the halacha? Because you're really cutting out the person's livelihood altogether. So that, you know, is consistent with the Aviyasah, for example, because once the first, the intervening net is going to be put there, none of the fish are going to go into the fisherman's net. But the Rashba has another understanding of that case, which is very halacha l'maise. And the Rashba's understanding of that case, and if you take a look, that's in the Mikoros, in Sheos, which was the Rashba, Chela Gimel Simen Pei Gimel, says that when somebody has already cultivated a customer, as it were, this fisherman has already cultivated these fish as his customers. Okay? It's when you've already cultivated a customer, so then it's not right for somebody to come along and to seize away your customer from you for their purposes. So therefore, it's in all of these shuvos that you'll see, the Lechem Rav and others, they'll say that while it may be appropriate for somebody else to come into town and to engage in creative and efficient business practices in order to draw business, particularly if they have a differentiated product and so forth, nonetheless, they don't have the right to actively pursue people whom they know to be the customers of the other person, and to say, up until now, you've been the customer of this person, we want to take you away and be our customer.
What has Gach Agency taken you for?
That's correct. So you can generally publicize your services and what you do and the types of packages and products that you offer, and if somebody comes to you independently, even though they may have previously frequented a different establishment, then you would be allowed to service them, but for you to actively try to lure them away from their previous patronage would be a violation of this halacha of Dagimit Diyavi Sira. There's another, source for this notion is the Gemara in Kiddushin and Daf Nun Tes that talks about Aniyah Mahapech Bacharora, that if you have somebody who has invested significant effort to acquire something or to conduct a particular transaction, that somebody who interferes with that is considered to be a Rasha. Even though, b'dieved, if it was done, it wouldn't undo the transaction if there hadn't been an actual kinyan that was performed. Nonetheless, it's considered to be highly improper, and therefore this is something which, at least in the first instance, can be prevented by a Bezdin if it's felt that somebody is actually trying to take a business away from somebody else who had cultivated that business. So I had a case, and that's, I gave you a copy, took out off the names of the parties. Well, by the way, Yirei Shemayim, everybody involved in this case, but these are just things that people don't necessarily think about all the time, where there was a mashgiach who, he was a rav who moved into a particular neighborhood, and he felt that as part of his being the rav of the community, he was entitled to receive the hashgacha of the establishments that were in the neighborhood, to be the mashgiach, to get money. There was a major national kashrus agency that was providing hashgacha on various establishments, and it's a parnasa to be a mashgiach. There was already another rav who was in that community who he felt didn't have the same affiliations with that major national kashrus agency who was already doing the hashgacha. So he went to the kashrus agency and he said, you should take away the hashgacha from this fellow who's been doing it, because now I'm in town and you should give me the hashgacha instead. And it was decided that this would be subject to a din torah, that we would decide. So the kashrus agency listened to him, and then the first person who had the previous hashgacha cried foul and said that this was a violation of my rights. So we pointed out that at least according to the Kstam Sofer, Simen Kuf Yud Chet, take a look, this is quoted in the Pisvei Tshuva over there. So the Kstam Sofer says very clearly that in this case, this is mamish taking away a person's livelihood, even if the person might have another source of income. If the individual already had the business relationship, already had the job, and you're luring away the establishments, or in this case the kashrus agency, from this individual, so that now he will no longer have the hashgacha, and now this person who's new to the town is going to have the hashgacha, so that is kind of a classic example of Yored Leumnes Chavero to interfere in that particular case, that's at the very least Ani Amahapik Lechorora, and potentially even in the domain of Dagim Diabi Sayara, that this type of, once somebody already has a particular customer, or somebody already has a particular hashkacha, that to utilize efforts, even if somebody feels that they're entitled to it, to lure the person and entice the person, to entice the employer away from this individual, or to entice a customer away from an establishment, it all falls within the same category. It's all considered to be a violation of this rule. So these are restrictions that halacha lemaiseh are still pertinent, you know, even though we have a relatively freewheeling model of open competition. But in the event that somebody is actively luring away a customer, clearly that's impermissible. Predatory price cutting is clearly impermissible. And trying to take away a position that was already occupied by somebody else is clearly impermissible as well. It's also the Tosos has a famous case along those lines as sort of a classic manifestation of Ani Amahapech Bechoror in Tosos Kiddushin Daf Nun Tes. He talks about a malamed that knows that there's another malamed working in who's being hired by somebody else, that it's improper for that malamed to say to the balabas, so, you know, I'm a better malamed, you should hire me instead of this individual, even if, objectively speaking, he thinks that he's a better malamed. What can he do? He can advertise his services, he can, you know, promote to the public, well, what a wonderful person, an employee and malamed he would be, and then if somebody wants to recruit him afterwards, they can do so, but to actively try to take away somebody else's business opportunity is something which one is not allowed to do. I'll just conclude. Yeah. I'm sorry. Even with kinasofrim, kinasofrim just means that there's a yeshiva in town. Now I'm allowed to establish another yeshiva in town. It doesn't mean that I'm allowed to go to a that I, as a rebbe, am allowed to go to another yeshiva and say you should fire this rebbe and hire me instead. Okay.
If you don't want to be yeshiva, you're going to the parents.
If you're going to
open up another yeshiva, you're going to the parents, tell them this, and I have another yeshiva.
No, but you're not saying you're just opening up the yeshiva, and anybody who can, because there are people who may not have made up their minds where they're going to send their children to school.
You're not going directly to
anybody who you know has made up their mind to enroll in the yeshiva for the other yeshiva for the upcoming year. And also yeshivas, at least nowadays, don't have such clear geographical boundaries. People travel from all over to go to a particular yeshiva.
Okay.
But that's the distinction which is drawn between the classical case of Mikri Dariki, and so that you're not allowed to lure away you're not allowed to, again, if you're a Rebbe, you're not allowed to try to take away another Rebbe's position affirmatively. But if you know the and remember, even if there's another yeshiva in town, you're not taking away that rebbe's parnasa, because you'll also there might be, you know, tamidim will go to this yeshiva, tamidim will go to another yeshiva. The hope is when you have multiple yeshivas, the kinasofim tabe chokma, that there'll be more chokma, there'll be more yeshivas, there'll be more people who will become, you know, learned, and there'll be, you know, more Torah learned.
There's 20 boys, there's 15 boys in this town. At some point,
there's never such a thing as too many yeshivas, okay? But you, no, seriously. And the Chazon Ish talks about this, because the Chazon Ish in the Sefer Emunah Bitachon, so he quotes, you know, from Yosef Shaul Nathanson, from Yad Shaul, where he has the case where there were Malamdim who came to town, the other Malamdim wanted to banish them and drive them out, and they were drawing a distinction between Mikri Dariki and Malamdim. It's not exactly the same thing. They're not teaching very small children, so older children, and therefore maybe it's not covered in the dispensation. He said that the whole thing is a late sonus, that the Gemara says very clearly that this is permissible, so therefore this is permissible. But the Chazanish says something which is very interesting. He says that a person might mistakenly be medamen milsa le milsa, that they might, you know, mistakenly come to the conclusion that because there are certain circumstances where we do say pasuk lechiyusei is impermissible, so therefore, you know, even in the case of melamdim, so you're going to extend the same principles, you have to really know what the halachas are. There is a special dispensation. The Gemara in Baba Basra says explicitly from Mikri Dardiki that they're always allowed to come to town. Luring away is a different story, but the notion of coming to town and establishing a yeshiva, he says, is 100% permissible. He says a person's mussar orientation and the fights that a person chooses, you know, to pursue, and the situations where a person should be more equanimous and say, well, this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants, and therefore I'll be satisfied with my lot, really depends upon a proficiency in the halacha. If people don't have a proficiency in the halacha, they'll wage battles, you know, for the sake of Torah that are completely antithetical to Torah, and they won't exercise hishtadlus in cases where they should exercise their hishtadlus. So the amount, so he points out, that the amount of, you know, hishtadlus and bitachon and musar orientation that a person should have when it comes to these situations really depend upon a formidable knowledge of the halacha. So that's just an important musar message to conclude this year with. Okay.